and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Iditarod Trail. While most 100th anniversary commemorations focus on a single date, the Iditarod National Historic Trail Centennial Celebration takes place over 5 years, from 2008 to 2012. On this week's Addressing Alaskans, geographer Dr. Tom Eli chronicles the history of the Iditarod Trail with a particular focus on Crow Creek Pass, a portion of the trail that sits right behind the Eagle River Nature Center. Recorded at the Eagle River Nature Center on November 21st, learn more about the history of Crow Pass and the Iditarod Trail next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
Yeah, mostly I don't teach at the university much anymore, but I'm an itinerant geographer, and people ask what that means. And that means that you can go study anything you want, but you don't get paid very much for it. So, but a couple of years ago, I was approached by the Historic Iditarod Trail Alliance, and they wanted to pull together some of the history of the Iditarod Trail, the historic Iditarod Trail, which you need to think of as something different than the Iditarod Sled Dog Race. And there's some conflict there. But anyway, and so I started pulling together. And I don't know how many of you have done historical research, but historical research is really a lot of fun. It can be frustrating, but it drives you down all sorts of weird and strange tangents. You start finding connections that make no sense whatsoever. You find out bits of information that nobody ever knew about. And then you have to try to find out information about something nobody knows about. How do you find out about somebody that's long dead? How do you, you know, you go back to the census stuff, and well, some of that's helpful and so forth. And so, and when I got this almost all done, I was called by someone and said, oh, you ought to go out to the Eagle River Nature Center and look at their book. And so I went out here and looked at the book on the Historic Iditarod Trail, and there's this interesting discussion of Girl Scouts. And so I've explored that. So I'm going to bring that into this because I think it's truly a remarkable, remarkable story. But I think the whole Iditarod Trail is a saga. And this is just sort of the stuff at the beginning and sort of at the end that people don't know about it. And I've called it Yellowstone Kelly. He's a real person and was up here. The Girl Scouts, 1974 and 75, and the historic Iditarod Trail. A couple of quotes that I really like that I'll start with. The enormity of Alaska's rugged terrain has always been placed a premium on transportation. Okay, that's true. Road, by Ambrose Bierce. For those of you that know Ambrose Bierce, he's sort of a dark fellow, but he's really kind of cool. Walked across the border into Mexico and was never seen again, maybe killed by Pancho Villa, who knows. Road, a strip of land along which one may pass from where it's too tiresome to be to where it is futile to go to. That's sort of optimistic on a Sunday afternoon. And then Charles Carroll. Bierce was right about the futility of the destination, but did not take into account the joys of the trip. Okay, there. I want you to think about five towns, like the five towns of Cibola, Goal, and the U.S. Mail. And that's how this story is all kind of played out in Alaska. And this is early Alaska. Of course, 1867, we became a state under the Department of the Treasury. 1868, we were put under the Department of the Army, as the Department of Alaska. We were put under the Army. In 1876, we became part of the Department of the Columbia, which is a military division of the U.S., so we were under the control of the Army back in those days. And then in 1896, 98, 90, and 02, there were a number of gold rushes, and then in 1908, there was the Iditarod gold rush. And these all sort of play into the story. Now, anybody know who this is?
Custer.
General Custer. George Arm, what does he have to do with Alaska?
I have no idea.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. This is one of those things that comes together. It's just like, how could this be? General Custer. Of course, we know now that President Obama is in a big to-do because he acknowledged Sitting Bull instead of Custer, and the people in Montana are still fighting Custer's last stand, which is now officially the battlefield at the Little Bighorn and not Custer's last stand. But when I was a kid, long years ago, there used to be this great poster that was out, and my parents would never let me get it. I wanted to get it, but it was Custer's last stand, and they have him in there, and he's being scalped, and it's really pretty cool. And it always brings me to mind of one of my favorite quotes from Ireland, from the Gaelic. A good run is better than a bad stand, and I think Custer probably could have taken heed to that in those days. But Custer was killed. And Custer had been slated to take over the Department of the Columbia. Oh, well. Along came Brigadier General Nelson Appleton Miles, who was put in charge of the Department of the Columbia. He was an old-time Indian fighter. He'd been in the Civil War. And he was very motivated. He wanted to get promoted. He knew how to get promoted in the Army. First off, you fight a whole bunch of battles, get a whole bunch of rewards. You curry some favor in Washington, you don't make anybody mad along the way, and then you try to find out some other unique things that you can do to improve your image. And he was sort of looking over the Department of Columbia, and he said, what is this Alaska business all about? And they said, well, that's up there, and it's on the Department of Columbia, and we don't know anything much about it, you know. There are a few soldiers, there are a few Marines that are stationed down in Sitka, but that's about the sum and total. And he goes, what? There are natives up there. There are Indians up there. We better check it out. So he went to Congress, and I might say that he was probably one of the more egotistical of the generals we've ever had in the Army, and that says a lot. But he was loved by his soldiers. He was the commanding general of the United States Army, no longer exists. He was the last surviving general from the Civil War on either side, and he was the last commanding general of the Army. Sort of a dapper looking guy there. But anyway, he looked at it and said to Congress, I want some money to send some exploration teams up there to find out what's going on in Alaska. Do we need, you know, do we have problems with Indians and all these sorts of things? And Congress said, no, we're not giving you any money. And so he said, okay, that's fine. I'll send them up there anyway. And he dispatched, either as the head of the Department of the Columbia or the commanding general of the Army, the U.S. Army, a number of exploration teams whose names of the leaders we've all heard. But we don't place him with Miles, General Miles, who's Miles City, Montana is named for, who was only in his position because Custer was killed. We had Frederick Swatka, Abercrombie, Henry T. Allen, Patrick Ray, Wiles P. Richardson, who comes back into our story, Captain Eldridge, Captain Abercrombie, Captain Glenn for the Glenn Highway, Lieutenant Kasner, which most people don't know, and Captain Glenn and Lieutenant Heron. And Captain Glenn was the head of what's called the Cook Inlet Exploring Expedition. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But this is Swatka. I just like people to kind of see who these people are and not just names. Swatka was an interesting fellow. These are all West Point sort of graduates by and large. He had both law and medical degrees. And he died an alcoholic in Seattle. But another thing to notice about some of these guys, they lived hard lives. But they lived an amazing long time for the time frame. It just shocks me. We have Henry Allen right there in the center on the left there. Now that's how an explorer should look, not Velcro and North Face and this sort of thing. He should look like that. And then later on, he became one of the most colorful U.S. cavalrymen of all times. He helped J.J. Pershing, General Pershing, chase Pancho Villa, and he was quite a character. But he lived to a ripe old age. Wiles P. Richardson. He was up here trying to put down some disturbances amongst the miners, and then later on came back here to Alaska. And then we had the Cook Inlet exploring expedition, 1898-1899, which was under the command of Captain Glenn, later Colonel Glenn. And they were looking for an all-American route to the Klondike. They didn't like that they had to go up Chilkoot Pass and go through the Canadian. They were looking for an easier passage up there. And they were also wanted to map the interior of Alaska, and they wanted to look for a route from a ice-free port to the Yukon River. Because once you're in the Yukon River, then you can go up to the Klondike country on a steamboat. But they also wanted to find out about the native peoples. Remember, General Miles was the old Indian fighter. And assess all the resources, the timber, the minerals, coal, fish, agriculture potential, and so forth. And this is Captain Glenn on the left here, sort of a nerdy looking guy. These are US Army snowshoes, which proved totally unusable. And they had to buy snowshoes from, and I'll show you a picture of one in a minute, from the natives, because those worked, these didn't work. In fact, they almost got killed. Captain Culp was the doctor. He almost got killed climbing on some ice in those US Army issue snowshoes, which still look like the snowshoes the Army still issues, by the way. And this is Major Glenn later in the Philippines, where he got into a bit of trouble. People don't know about this, but he was court-martialed and ultimately found innocent, but he was charged with waterboarding. So waterboarding has been around for a long time. And this is one of his assistants, Lieutenant Kasner. I think he is a pretty dashing looking guy there, with his horses and mules and the two kind of scraggly looking soldiers with him. He was an amazing leader. He later became a brigadier general. He's buried in, and this is not a very good picture, but it's his tombstone. It's in the Presidio National Museum or National Cemetery down in San Francisco. And right near it is Lawrence Kasner. And people kind of remember him a little bit, maybe. He was the son of the General Kasner, but he was the head of the Kasner's cutthroats up here during the Second World War. So there's a connection, you know, father to son. He didn't live very long. He only lived about 47 years, had stomach problems. And then there was Walter Mendenhall, sort of the egghead doctor, but who liked to take pictures. He was a geologist doctor. And he later became the head of the United States Geological Survey. A very, very famous man, but sort of an unlikely civilian guy to thrown together with all these Army guys. But it worked. It worked. Sergeant William Yannert, who retired in 1902 from the Army, moved with his brother to a place called Purgatory on the Yukon River. He called it Purgatory because it was a hell of a place to live, he said. I've done a bit of a study on Sergeant Yannert. He was a good map maker. He was from Poland, but he made maps, and he was with the cavalry. These are all cavalry guys, and he was down looking for Geronimo with the cavalry guys in Arizona before coming up here. And all I can say is he is one of the most splendid map makers that you'll ever find. This is actually his last visit to Purgatory before he died. Kind of a dapper fellow. That's one of his maps that he made, just with a compass. Just absolutely a work of art, what can I say? I've taken this little oxbow here and this island over here, see if I can point it out to you, right here, and compared it to a current topographic map using GIS, computer technology, and all that. It's not far off, considering the changes that the rivers have brought about and so forth. It's pretty inspiring. Yellowstone Kelly, Luther Sage Yellowstone Kelly. He had been General Miles' personal scout and interpreter. All these other guys were young guys. They'd been in West Point during the Indian Wars. Miles wanted to be sure that he had somebody up here that knew about Indians, knew the real story here. So he sent up Yellowstone Kelly, who I might point out here, missing a finger that got shot off by an Indian in a battle. Well, it was hanging there. And then the blacksmith cut it off with a hoof knife. And he says it's the most painful thing he ever had in his whole life. He was a scout and interpreter. He's buried over in Billings, Montana. But he experimented up here with the heliograph. General Miles was enthralled with the heliograph. Anybody know what a heliograph is? It's like a big mirror, and you reflect the sun off of it, and you use that to send Morse code. You can communicate. They communicated completely across Cook Inlet using the heliograph, and they used it out on the plains, and it worked really well. He also wanted to find out if the Indians up here knew sign language. They didn't. Or could use smoke signals. Well, he tried that, and that didn't work either, so, you know, oh well. And he was only up here in 1898, and in 1899 he came back up with the Harriman expedition as Mr. Harriman's personal guide. But interesting individual. Then we had the Five Towns. And when they first came up here, they were in Whittier, which was called Portage Bay then. That was the known ice-free port. Seward was, but they thought Whittier might work. Valdez was known. So, but if they wanted to get to the interior, they had to somehow get across the mountains. They had to get from Portage Bay across to what was called Old Kinnick, which is really New Kinnick, because Old Kinnick is kind of between New Kinnick and Old Kinnick. And so New Kinnick is really New Kinnick. So anyway, but we call it a Klutna. And so they wanted to figure out how to get across these mountains, and it was an endeavor. They had a lovely time in the rain over there, and they had a lot of mosquitoes, and they didn't like it very much. Plus, at the same time, 1898, the Spanish-American War was going on, and all the other guys were going to the war, and they were like, we're up here in mosquitoes and we're losing out, and everybody else is going down there and going to get the laurels and the promotions. And well, what they did was they put Yellowstone Kelly and Walter Mendenhall together as a team to find a way across the Chugach Mountains. And I always think of it as sort of the scientist in the Indian scout. You could see the big snowshoes that they ultimately got, the Indian snowshoes, that worked a heck of a lot better than the Army issue variety. But they worked together very well. And what they did was, first off, they went from here, down to here, over to here, and then, whoops, we're back here. And then they decided, no, this, they had heard that this was a way, and so they went up this way. And they got up into the mountains so bad, it was like, this is not a good deal. So they explored around some more, and then they moved over to Tyonek, and ultimately Tyonek became a big place. But they learned that there were two possible trails across the Chugach Mountains. And this is what Mendenhall wrote. There are at least two routes by land between Kinnick and Turnagain Arms. One, much the shorter, easiest, and best known, is by way of Indian Creek. And Indian Creek's trail is still out there. Some of you may have skied it or hiked it. Starts down there in Indian, actually. The other route, followed by the rider in company with Mr. Kelly, is by way of the Glacier and Eucla, Eagle River, creeks. This route appears not to be much known before, and probably will not be much used except by prospectors who wish to reach the upper reaches of Raven Creek and upper Eucla River. A pack trail could be constructed over it, but not without considerable outlay. These guys are looking for trails, and they're not talking about dog trails. We're talking about horse trails and wagon trails. Big time movement, and I can imagine taking a pack team over Crow Creek Pass. Be interesting. Mendenhall didn't like Crow Creek Pass one bit at all. Kelly said, I consider the route traversed the Crow Creek Pass to the Kinnick Arm a practicable one. As to whether heavy snowfall in winter in the divide will block the travel for animals remains to be seen. But should a trail once be established and be kept open by travel, I believe it'd be all right. I have a hard time with that, but he thought, but those guys were tough. And they knew horses and they knew mules, and they probably had some insight. So we had these two trails, the Indian Creek Trail, or Indian Pass Trail, some people call it, and of course, the Crow Creek Pass, which is part of the Iditarod Historic Trail. 1898. So they could get across there. And actually, they really didn't need, once they've done all this work, they really didn't need to go very much across there, because they set up a base in Tyonek, and then they set up a base in Kinnick, and they could take boats up and down, and it was sort of a, okay, well, that was fun, but we're not going to use it very much. Okay, now, the rest of the story is about mail and sea ice. Remember Nome over here? Part of the year is surrounded by ice. It's one of the most isolated places in Alaska. Not the most isolated, but one. And people there, it was a big city, and people wanted mail on a regular basis. And they couldn't get it in the wintertime, so they wanted a mail trail. So they complained to the Department of the Army and said, we want a mail trail. So in 1905, the Alaska Roads Commission was formed, and the act, I just love this quote, because it sort of sets the stage for all of Alaska and all the things that go on here. It's an act to provide for the construction and maintenance of roads, the establishment and maintenance of schools, and the care and support of insane persons in the District of Alaska and for other purposes. We'll just throw everybody in there together. And so they established this road commission under the command of Major Wiles P. Richardson, George Pillsbury, and Samuel Orchard. And they were given a little bit of money, but not a whole bunch of money. And one of the things they said was, you can get any money you can keep any money that you can get from taxing whiskey. So they started taxing the bars, and there was a big to-do over it. But they were to make wagon roads, winter sled trails, dog team trails, and their first project was, they felt, the Valdez to Fairbanks Trail. That was the way to go. And so that was their first project, the trail to Fairbanks. That was a wagon road in the summer, dog sled or sleigh in the wintertime, and then across the northern route to Nome along the Yukon River, the Tanana, and then, of course, the Yukon. In 1908, Wiles P. Richardson directed Walter L. Goodwin, and nobody knew who he was. He was the engineer at Nome, to mark a winter trail from Seward to Nome. And so, you know, that was one of the first things I said, well, who is this guy Goodwin? And nobody knows. I couldn't find much about him. So I called him the elusive Walter Goodwin. But in 1908, he was told in the beginning of January that he needed to go, and by the end of January, he was on the trail. These guys were good. They didn't mess around. And there's their dog teams. And they went from Seward up across the Crow Creek Pass to Old Kinnick, to New Kinnick, to Squintna. And of course, they came along the old railroad right away. And if you know the history of the railroad, it started and stopped and started and stopped. And there were several evolutions of the Alaska railroad system. But when they got up about Portage and all, it sort of the ice out there sort of went to hell for places to run dog teams. So they cut up through Crow Creek Pass to the Crow Creek Mine, which was there. They stayed there for a couple days. Then they went on across the pass, out to Kinnick, New Kinnick, the roadhouse, a little later, but it was there. And then on across to McGrath, Tocotna, Iditarod, Ophir, Caltag, Unalakleet, and all the way to Nome. Now, the route from Caltag to Nome had been open for a long, long time. Everybody knew that route. But the route between Kinnick and Ophir, or Iditarod, was a new one. And the whole reason this ended up being the Iditarod Trail was that this was in January of 1908, and in December of 1908 they discovered gold. And so people started to think of this trail as a trail to the gold fields and not a mail trail to Nome. And now we think of it as a dog race that starts in Kinnick, usually, supposed to, and not really a trail that started in Seward. And that's what the Historic Iditarod Trail Alliance is interested in, bringing more attention to the trail between Seward and Kinnick, or Susitna. And they found that the route cut off a whole bunch of miles, as opposed to going through Fairbanks and then going across. Any He kept track of his paces the whole way, this guy Goodwin, and then knew that he, you know, like 2.5 feet per pace times, you know, 10 million paces, and you get this many miles that we went, and therefore we've saved this many miles. I mean, it was just like, this guy was pretty phenomenal. And again, there was the Christmas Day, Christmas time gold rush in Iditarod. And Goodwin was a superintendent in Nome, and I'll just tell you a little bit about Nome here, because it's not as exciting a part of the story, but it's actually kind of interesting. But you can see what a big town it is. Power lines, they had telephones, they had electricity. I mean, it was uptown. They had automobiles. And this is Goodwin's house. This is the only other thing we could find about it. The internet's supposed to have all the information. This is the information on the internet. And there were the Goodwin Glocker nuptials. Now, who's getting married here? Is it Mr. and Mrs. Goodwin's house? Is that their kid marrying somebody? You know, what's going on? Turns out, actually, it's his brother who works for his brother in the road commission. And oftentimes, the people in Nome, the non-native people, would leave in the wintertime and go down to Seattle. And the Goodwins and a lot of people spent all the winters in Seattle and then came back up for the spring. And then they decided that's the route we want. And they convinced Richardson, who was the head of the road commission, to have the trail built. And Richardson told Goodwin, build the trail. Go from Nome back to Seward and stake the trail. So he departed on 12 November, which is not that long ago, 100 years from this month, and headed back with a group of men, and they marked the trails. They blazed or marked the trails all the way, actually from the Yukon River, from Cowtag, all the way to Seward. This was Walter Goodwin here. And on the way back, he kept track of the miles too, but he had a cyclometer, he got a bicycle wheel. He actually got two of them. And he could measure the distance it went around and how far they go. Well, the first day out in the trail, they lost one of the wheels, it was gone. But the other one stayed the whole way, and they found that they actually were saving more time, more distance than they had thought. This is how they marked it, well, with tripods. And this, of course, is the official mark of the Iditarod Trail Dog Race. It's the Iditarod, Historic Iditarod Alliance symbol. And even in the old days, they would mark trails with these tripods. This is 1913, same time. Tripods were used by Wildcats. It came from actually the Civil War. They could put those up really quickly. It didn't take much work. And they figured that one guy could go out here and adjust these telegraph lines. And so they were very simple. You could put it on wet ground, and then when the ground thawed, it just kind of set. Or they would put it on ice, and when the ice melted, it would just settle down, and it'd be fine. And even our Chugiak Electric is still using, this is along Dowling Road, still using tripods for the exact same reason. The ground's really wet. It's easy to put those up, and they stay pretty stabilized. Although they did say that the linemen really don't like climbing those. Now they climb them, of course. And they don't like climbing the tripods. It's not a lot of fun, I guess. And of course, at the same time, they're talking about airplanes. Airplanes are going to do it. But of course, we know that airplanes didn't come in until about 1929 for the delivery of mail. But they came back, marking the trail the whole way. And this time, instead of going on the Crow Creek Pass, they went on the Indian route to see how it was. Stopped at the Eagle River Roadhouse, went back to Seward, and this is one of the largest shipments of gold. And the trail was staked, and people started using it, and they started raising dogs. They had a dog ranch in the Nash Ranch, actually is still in Seward if you go down there. And I thought this was sort of an interesting quote when he got back. The entire route, Seward to Iditarod, can be a horse route. But on account of very deep snow, it means that traffic with horses would have to begin with the inception of winter, and the trail would be kept beaten down and broken all winter. With sufficient travel, one could last a winter ride on a dog team sled from Old Connick to Iditarod. But again, think horses.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with geographer Dr. Tom Eli. His talk on Crow Pass and the Iditarod Trail was recorded at the Eagle River Nature Center on November 21st.
So, Goodwin had been there in Nome as a superintendent. They moved him down to, as a superintendent in Seward and made him in charge of the section between Seward and basically Kinnick. It said Iditarod, but he was really in charge of all the way to Kinnick. And he made the decision on the Crow Creek Pass being the actual trail route. And this is an article from the newspaper. Mr. Goodwin says Seward is very dull. Many going outside this fall, but he thinks well of the future. And so the Iditarod Trail was worked on through Crow Creek Pass, 1910, 1911. Teams were starting to go. 1916, they worked on it. It was in pretty good condition by 1916. Regular mail actually started in 1916, but plenty of people had gone both ways over it. Iditarod Gold Rush by 1914 was gone. And then the Alaska Railroad opened up between Seward and Anchorage, and then later all the way to Wasilla. And so there was no reason to ride a dog team across the mountains here. You know, you just ride the train. It was a heck of a lot easier. 1917, Joe Reddington was born. 1917, World War I started, and almost all these people up here were called, all the young men at least, were called away to the war. Wiles P. Richardson and Goodwin and all of them, they left Alaska and they never returned. By 1918, Crow Creek Pass was largely abandoned. 1920, the miners up there demanded that the Alaska Road Commission, they waited till after the war, fortunately, that the Alaska Road Commission do something to improve the trail because they couldn't get to their mining claims. And the Alaska Road Commission said, yeah, we'll do something about that, and they never did. And Walter Goodwin was down in Seattle working as the chief of maintenance for the highway department. 1923, Warren Harding, the railroad was in. Man, the whole thing was history, even the trails across the center. Now you could ride the train to Nenana, put your dog sled, and of course we all know that this is the route that was taken during the diphtheria epidemic over in Nome, where the serum went up to Nenana and then was carried by the series of mushers from Nenana to Nome. And a lot of these mushers didn't think they did very much. It was really exciting. I mean, it's just like me throwing something in my pickup truck, driving 10 miles and then handing it to you, you know, and then it was like, what's the big deal about that? But, you know, they went down in history. A lot of them had been steamboat captains on the rivers and all, and they felt that was way more impressive than what they did. But Walter Goodwin, he remained elusive. We couldn't find out anything about him. And then I started looking around, and having been in the military, I decided to check his military record because he was called colonel, and I thought, well, maybe he's a colonel. But they called lots of supervisors in those days colonels or captains, and they weren't really military. But he had been in the military, he joined up for the Spanish-American War, and I like this. It says he was minutely inspected and entirely sober, and he met all the requirements. He was 5 feet, 5 inches tall. He was single. He had a few scars and hairy moles and a tattoo on his right arm. And it says he was born in Nebraska City, Nebraska. And then I found his death certificate. I tried to find the wedding certificate, but you can't find the wedding certificate unless you know when he was born, where he was born, all these sorts of things, and when they got married and where, you know, what state. I mean, it could have been. And it says he was born in Omaha. The military records say Nebraska City. His parents were Colonel J.N. and Sarah Larkin. His wife was Mary. He died a year after having surgery, stomach surgery, in Seattle. His degree, or his obituary, which was interesting, said he had a degree in civil engineering, but it never said where. And I've checked around, and I can't find any records anywhere. His father, it says his father was the mining editor for the Salt Lake City Tribune. C.C. Goodwin was the editor of the Salt Lake City Tribune at that time, and he had an interest in mining. There's no relation, there's no record of Colonel Goodwin working for the Salt Lake City Times. C.C. Goodwin was sort of an interesting guy because his whole, other than mining, his whole other interest was sort of attacking the Mormons in Utah. And so he was sort of a very controversial character. It says he was an engineer during the construction of the White Pass Yukon Railroad, that he discovered the Engineer Mine. He didn't discover the Engineer Mine. He and a bunch of surveyors were laying out a trail for the Yukon White Pass Railroad, and they ran into these miners and said, "We've discovered this mine, but we need some money. Can you guys give us some money and so we can do the mine?" And they said, "Yeah, okay, but you know, we want some of the money." And some of you that know history know that the president of the Engineer Mine died on the Princess Sophia when it sunk down out of Skagway. They worked on Alaska railroads near Valdez. During World War I, he supervised the construction of railroads and storage facilities near Columbus, Ohio. That was really pretty boring. But he determined the route for the Mulholland Drive in Hollywood, the very scenic drive. Survived by his widow and all these sorts of things, a cousin, Mrs. Joseph Wilson, was married to a brother of the late President Wilson. The whole family, the two brothers, there were two sisters, they were all up here at the same time. One of the sisters was married to an engineer who was working on the Alaska White Pass Railroad. She got tired of being left in Skagway, so she went up and worked on the beaches in Nome gold mining. She was quite a character. And the other sister, Clara, she went out and lived in the Aleutian Islands on a fox farm. But from 1905 to 1929, he remained a resident of the state of Washington. And then here's the Alaska Road Commission. Just kind of tell you what happened to some of these guys. Remember Wiles, Richardson, Pillsbury, and Orchard? Richardson went to war, became a general, led some troops in Europe, and then he was sent by J.J. Pershing to Russia when the U.S. invaded Russia at Murmansk during the Russian Civil War and tried to put it down. They lasted there for about 3 months, and then they said, "Man, this is not working very well," so they pulled him back out. He retired from the Army in 1920 and just lived in the Army Navy Club in Washington, D.C. for the rest of his life. Never married. You kind of can envision this old guy in there, you know, with his bathrobe on. Too bad. Buried at West Point, and of course, the Richardson Highway, it was named for him. Pillsbury. He was a big buddy of one of his classmates from West Point by the name of MacArthur. And he became his confidant, and he happened to rise very rapidly in the Army and was in charge of building forts all over. And in Alaska, there's a Mount Pillsbury that's named for him. And if you're driving up the Richardson Highway toward Delta, and you see Donnelly Dome, when you first see Donnelly Dome, if you look off to the left, the tallest peak over there is Pillsbury. Now, there's some trivia for you. Now, Samuel Orchard, he was a dispersing officer. He had the money, and he embezzled $16,000, and he got thrown in the big-time jail. 6 years, dishonorable discharge. President Taft commuted it to 2 years, and he died working as an oil field laborer in Texas. He was bad. 1932, the Road Commission went to the Department of the Interior. And in 1968, a guy by the name of Barry Hill came up here because people from Anchorage wanted to use the Crow Creek Pass. They thought, "Oh, there might be some recreational things up there." So they sent him up here. He looked at it and he said, "You know, these switchbacks are in doggone good condition. I think people could come up here." Most of these were all of these were the switchbacks that were constructed by Walter Goodwin. 1973, the first Iditarod sled dog race was won. And then 1975, a most amazing thing happens, and some of you have read the book over there, so you kind of know about this. There was a project that was put together by a woman by the name of Terry Dittman and some Girl Scouts to reopen the Iditarod Trail, the Crow Creek Pass Trail. And they did. Now, this is Terry today, and this is one of the ladies that helped her, Jan Smith, Jan Reinholt. And they took these young women, 14 to 18, and had these women develop the project. These young Girl Scouts, senior Girl Scouts, developed the project. They didn't take over the project and say, "Okay, you do this, and you do this, and you do this." They said, "Okay, guys, here it is. You guys figure out how to do it. I'll help you make contacts, but you know, you're responsible for making this happen. And they did, and it worked, and it was really wonderful. They had two park rangers from Chugach National or State Park that helped, Mike Rodak and Doug Fessler, Mr. Glacier, and they were out there with them on the trail and helped them decide where the trail should go. But the young women made all those decisions. It was just really, really quite amazing. They obtained support from the Army National Guard. They got the National Guard to fly out all sorts of stuff. They would fly out anything they wanted except food. They could not fly out food. And Terry Dittman said she wasn't sure about that, but she thought it might be something related to, there might be some liability if somebody got sick or something, or food poisoning. Well, it's because the National Guard flew it out, you know, and yada, yada. But they did all sorts of things. They got Seabees to come out and help them build the bridges. They go, well, we don't know how to build bridges, but who knows how to build bridges? Well, the Seabees know how to build bridges. They called them up. Seabees said, yeah, sure, we'll do it. Yeah, they came out and helped them. Ted Stevens, he got them some money. They put a proposal in, young ladies, wrote the proposal to the Reader's Digest Historic Grant, and this was to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the U.S., and they got money for it. They got money for America Beautiful Foundation, and then all sorts of other support, including airdrops of McDonald's hamburgers and pizzas and all sorts of things. Now, I was putting this together, I was thinking of this in today's terms. I mean, if you're a young person, you're going to spend all summer up in country like this. Actually, they divided into two teams. They were sort of 15 days in the field, 15 days out. One of the teams started at Girdwood, one of the teams started here, and they sort of met in the middle like the railroads coming across the states. But what did you have to do? You had to carry all your stuff on your back. Can you imagine that? And the cell phones probably didn't work very well up there either. You had to climb mountains. You had to carry it. This is Cindy Roberts. Some of you may know Cindy in town. She was one of the helpers off and on. You had to stop on the top of hills, and you had to sleep in tents. I don't know how many people would do that. I was just looking on MSNBC before I came out here, and it was an article about young women, teenagers who can't get away from their texting for longer than about 10 minutes. You know, and then they start to have, you know, serious like withdrawal. You know, like and you can see it on airplanes with people too. You know, they've got it. But these women, these young women did it. They went out there and they worked. My gosh, you have to work after you do all this. Haul stuff, cut stuff by hand. They had one chainsaw and only Terry would do the chainsaw. The girls weren't allowed to do the chainsaw. But the girls set up, they made a base camp for each time they were out. And then they would walk out to where they were working. And some of the times from where they were working from their base camp was 5 miles one way. So they hike out 5 miles, they work their butts off all day, and then they hike 5 miles back. Now, how many people are going to do that today? None of us would. We'd be like, get us a helicopter, you know, we'll just helicopter back to town tonight, you know, sort of thing. And they put up signs that marked the trails. And this is one of the trail signs, and I'm just laying on my computer, and I forgot to bring it. I'm really sorry, but they're really pretty neat. That was the original trail signs for the trail systems. This is one of the bridges on the right that the Seabees built. But here are the young ladies, some of the little places they went, built little bridges they built across wet spots. They carried rocks. They made cairns, and they named these cairns. They had the Richard Nixon cairn, remember the time. They had the Mama Cass cairn, and a bunch of different cairns. They had a whole bunch of really clever names. And they took very great pride in building these cairns, and there many of them are still out there. And the most exciting part of the whole adventure, I guess, was the river crossing. They put up the sign that said river crossing, and then they took it down because they figured maybe there could be some liability with this, and maybe that's not always the best exact place to cross the river, and maybe we better let people decide to cross wherever they want. And so here we have crossing the river, and this is actually Terry Dittman out here in the front with this monster pack on. And she would often carry the chainsaw back and forth. And I asked if they had any bear problems. And she said the only time they had a bear problem was that she was by herself and she was crossing the river up there and there was a brown bear on the other side and she had a chainsaw and she didn't know what to do. And she fell down and then just like, oh man, this is all going south really quick. And then she got the chainsaw back up there and the bear kind of went away and it was all, the world was in harmony again. And sometimes the crossing was really exciting. Here we got someone that's already in the water. And so they held on. But a number of these girls, this young lady right here, Christine Sowell, she's from Anchorage. Her dad was actually a biologist. Her brothers work over for K2UU as film guys. And she's a biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Service now. And this becoming a biologist was inspired by being out here and with Mike Rodak and Duck Fessler. They named a number of places. Mount Heritage, this was the 200th anniversary. Yakutiak Creek, Icicle Creek, a number of creeks they gave names to. And then Terry said, well, why don't you guys get these names made official? So they went to the Geographic Names Board, petitioned them to have the names adopted, and they were approved. In fact, the young women did this. The adults didn't. And of course, Terry got this great state park appreciation certificate. And she's really kind of embarrassed about that because she says that the real winners in this were the young women themselves. And it was not a project she did, it was a project she was on. And she sort of provided the oversight and the safety, you know, sort of the guidance and counsel if they needed it. But she let them make the decision. I don't know if you've ever worked on a project with young people like that. But it's really interesting because there's sometimes they'll labor with something and you want to jump in and say, just do this, you know, and get over this. But you got to let them figure that out for themselves. And that's what she did. And it's a real hard thing. And I admire the whole way they did this. They learned so much more from this adventure than having just a working sort of adventure. These young women were empowered. They ran the project. They ran the project well. They made all the decisions. They did, ordered the supplies. They decided what needed to be done. They decided who did what. And if they needed to contact people for support, they did it, not the adults. The adults were there for oversight and safety. The young women had ownership in this project, and they still feel ownership in this trail. And Terry said she thinks that this taught the youth that they can really do something valuable at an early age. And it's carried, I think, them through, at least according to Terry. So it's an interesting story, and there's way more to it than that. But it's truly amazing part of this whole Iditarod history. 1978 became the historic trail, Iditarod National Historic Trail. 1984, the Crow Creek Marathon. 98 was the Trail Alliance was formed. And now we're in the 100th anniversary of the historic Iditarod Trail, 2008 through 2012. 2010 was when they came back. 2011 is when they started rebuilding it on the trip led by Walter Goodwin in 1908. Now, what can you do? What can you do? Well, you can go out there and enjoy it. You can go to the Iditarod Trail a number of places. You could start right here at the Eagle River Nature Center, of course. And you could, in the summertime, you could probably ski some of it. I talked to someone about taking a dog team across there, and she said, I don't know, it'd be kind of a little hinky, she thought, because of the avalanches. And later on, the Iditarod Trail in 1917 was actually the Crow Creek Pass Trail was almost abandoned entirely for use of the Indian Pass Trail because there were too many avalanches, and Goodwin thought there were going to be too many avalanches on the Indian Pass Trail. So anyway, but you can hike the trail or the Rodak Nature Trail, which I think is sort of an ironic connection here that these two things are on the same side, since he was one of the guys that was one of the helpers out there, did so much for them. You can go up to Girdwood, and there's trails up there, the Winter Creek Trail, which connects into a bunch of the Iditarod Trail, which is along the road there as you drive up toward the big parking area there if you're going to go over Crow Creek Pass. There's a number of signs there, and there are parking places now that you can get out and hike on the Iditarod Trail. You can go to the Crow Creek Mine, which is, it's pretty interesting. If you want to go gold mining, that's it's sort of fun. But the buildings, most of the buildings were there when Goodwin came through, and it's really pretty cool to see a lot of those things. Or you can go down to Seward, which is a big, big time Iditarod town, of course. And they consider the trail to be the Seward Nome Trail, not the Iditarod Trail. They're kind of miffed that they're left out of the picture because they were the original ice free port that it was going to come from. And I agree with them. And there are places down there where you can get onto the Iditarod Trail and hike. You can join the Trail Alliance or the Trail Blazers. They're two different groups that their newsletters look exactly the same, but they both are involved in maintaining the trail and supporting the trail. You can be a good steward of the trail when you're on it. If you clean up trash or debris or whatever you see, or report any sort of egregious behaviors you might see to here or to the troopers or whoever, and support federal legislation or state legislation that supports the trail. It's really a true gem, and of course the Crow Creek Pass is a real gem for all of us here. And most of all, get out and see it. Well, sort of in good conclusion, if Yellowstone Kelly were around today, he'd be 161 years old. That's kind of interesting. Walter Goodwin would have been a mere 139, although that's only 39 years older than that guy that just gave up his car keys in today's paper. Mm-hmm. And most of these adventurous Girl Scouts are now in their 50s or close to it. So a lot has passed, but they did an amazing job, all of these people. They went out there, they did what needed to be done. And that impresses me. I really like it. I mean, and you read their tales of it, and you don't hear a bunch of whining, oh, meow, except for when they were over in Portage about the mosquitoes and the rain, and we can all understand that whining, but I mean, they went out and they worked, they were begging on the, when they were building the Iditarod Trail back with Goodwin, they were begging for temperatures colder than 40 below, because then they could stop working. You know, it's like, these guys were tough, we want some 42 below weather, man. I'm sorry, the thermometer only goes to 40 below, you know, everybody's working. And I think the spirit of all three of these folks, these groups, will always be out there on the Crow Creek Pass. When I go out there, I like to think of them all out there. It makes it a lot neater to know that there are some people that really put their hearts and souls into this trail. And it goes back to what Ambrose Bierce said when I talked about it at the beginning. Bierce was right about the futility of the destination, but he did not take into account the joys of the trip. And all these people and all their work out there on the Iditarod Trail, I think they enjoyed it. The girls did, certainly. Walter Goodwin's and Yellowstone Kelly's chronicles, they had a good time. They worked hard, but they enjoyed it. It was a joyous time for them. And so we have to admire people like that. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with geographer Tom Eli. His talk, chronicling the history of Crow Pass and the Iditarod Trail, was recorded at the Eagle River Nature Center on November 21st, 2010. This year, 2010, is the midway year during the Iditarod National Historic Trail Centennial Celebration, which takes place over 5 years, from 2008 to 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.